We all love civil defence in this podcast. How ordinary people can try to protect themselves in war. But the concept has been given several different names in Britain. During the war, and for much of the Cold War, it was known as civil defence. But in the 1980s, the government tried calling it home defence to try and maybe shift us away from thoughts of the Blitz and tin hats and Anderson shelters. Because, as we've discussed before, that all worked perfectly well on the home front during the war, but was very often the downfall of nuclear civil defence planning. That it all just seemed too bloody similar to what we'd done back in the 40s. There had been no great invention or development, nothing new had sprung up to protect us from the new threat. It was just really the same old stuff. So let's try calling it home defence, they thought. And then, when the Cold War ended, we largely dropped the word defence, perhaps to try and soothe us, to stress that war, for now, was over. So we started calling it emergency planning. And this was an umbrella term which covered planning for disasters, for train crashes and floods and fires and radiation spills. It wasn't just war. But then it changed again. Maybe the use of the word emergency in there was still causing alarm. So we moved towards calling it resilience planning, or just resilience. And that's a positive word. Using defence and emergency might prompt unease, but the word resilience implies that we're tough and strong and prepared and steady. If it happens, we can take it. Which, ironically, loops us right back to the Blitz, when one of the most common morale-boosting sayings was that London can take it. There was even a propaganda film of the same name, made in 1940 by the Ministry of Information. And this was shown in cinemas here, but also in America, to, of course, encourage her to enter the war. Let's hear a clip.
Dr. Paul Joseph Gibbles said recently that the nightly air raids have had a terrific effect upon the morale of the people of London. The good doctor is absolutely right. Today the morale of the people is higher than ever before. They are fused together, not by fear, but by a surging spirit of courage the like of which the world has never known. They know that thousands of them will die, but they would rather stand up and face death than kneel down and face the kind of existence the conqueror would impose upon them. But a bomb has its limitations. It can only destroy buildings and kill people. It cannot kill the unconquerable spirit and courage of the people of London. London can take it.
So, to Sweden. If war or some other cataclysm should strike the country, they aim to respond with what they call total defence. Now, that doesn't mean throwing loads of guns and bombs and planes at threat. It means that the whole of society is expected to respond. It's a union of military defence and civil defence. So total defence means that responding to the threat, whatever it might be, is not just a job for the men or for the people in uniform. Everyone is expected to muck in. Society will respond. So it's not just the armed forces and the medical staff and the scientists and the firemen and the politicians. Even a young mother at home with babies or an elderly man is expected to play their part in total defence. Now, you might shrug and say, yeah, big deal, most countries have a concept of civil defence, so what's so different about Sweden saying that it'll run alongside the military defence? Well, the Swedish concept of total defence is more than just a series of guidelines saying, as we might have seen in Britain during the Cold War, okay, if there is an attack, We'd expect the military to battle the bad guys, whilst the Women's Royal Voluntary Service will go into bombed areas to distribute food and blankets. So there, you have military doing X and civil defence doing Y, with the general idea that the country will pull through. Sweden's total defence is more specific than that. It's like a philosophy, if you will, a way of thinking. It says that every Swedish person, whether a tough soldier or a little old lady, should respond when their country is under attack or under threat. Of course, they both have different capabilities, so they will both be expected to do very different things, but the point is, there will be an expectation upon them. They will be expected to act, whether that's by donning the uniform or by making sure there's a well-stocked first aid box and lots of clean drinking water stored in the house. Both types of action will help Sweden. This is total defence. Action is expected from every single person who is able. Another important aspect of Sweden's total defence is its inclusion. The current way of thinking is that everyone who lives in Sweden is Swedish, at least for the purposes of total defence. If you're here and you live here, then you're one of us and you'll be expected to respond. In fact, there is more than just an expectation to respond. The Swedish authorities say that the population have a, quote, duty to contribute to Sweden's total defence. This duty extends to everyone, man or woman, who lives in Sweden and is between the ages of 16 and 70. All of these people can be called up to assist in various ways. Quote, everyone is obliged to contribute and everyone is needed. It's obvious, of course, that not everyone in that huge group can put on a uniform and brandish a gun. So total defence means there are lots of ways to contribute. The first is the most obvious, that's conscription into the armed forces. But you might also, depending on your age and your fitness and your skills, etc., be conscripted into another government organisation. The third option is, well, it applies to those who work in essential roles. Say you're a nurse or a police officer, or you work in the defence industry. In that case, you can't be conscripted into either the army or a government organisation. You must stay at your post so the country can continue to function throughout the crisis, or to function as smoothly as possible. But the central message of total defence is that you cannot be passive. You cannot sit back and let the authorities deal with it whilst you just keep your head down. Maybe you can't take up one of those roles. Maybe you can't be conscripted, or you can't work in an essential industry. Maybe you're a single parent with a bunch of kids at home. Maybe you're a carer, or you have health problems yourself. Even then, there is still a lot of practical stuff that you can do to help. And that falls under what the Swedish call home preparedness. Now, this will be familiar to anyone who has read a civil defence booklet. It's about stockpiling non-perishable food and drinking water, getting a battery-powered radio, warm clothing, and a first aid kit. So again, the message is everyone should get involved. So total defence goes beyond simple stockpiling of the home. It is a way of thinking. We are all in this together. And if you allow your cupboard to go bare, if you don't have a first aid kit, then when the crisis comes, you will be putting a strain on your neighbours, on your town, on your country, because you will be in need of help and resources from someone else. You will be adding to the demand, adding to the burden. So Sweden will suffer because you didn't play your part. So total defence is asking the individual to realise that they are part of a huge jigsaw which makes up Sweden. You are part of the society. That's very different, of course, from Britain's Protect and Survive, which had the message that you need to look after yourself and which arguably portrayed neighbours and fellow citizens as competitors and rivals and house grabbers. So total defence is a way of thinking, and that is why the Swedish Psychological Defence Agency was established. Because, as we mentioned, it's about more than just having tins on shelves and a bottle of disinfectant under the sink. And this Swedish Psychological Defence Agency is part of the Ministry of Defence. Going by its title alone, you might think such a body would be under the Ministry of Health or of Education. But no, it's defence. It has three departments. The first two seem quite standard, so we'll skim over them. The admin department and the operations department. It's the third department which interests us. The capability development department. Here is some blurb from their site describing what they do. It says that they develop and strengthen the overall societal capability in terms of psychological defence. This includes providing support to the Swedish population, government agencies, the media, voluntary defence organisations, and civil society in general. Other key tasks include training, exercises, and knowledge development. For example, initiating and funding research related to psychological defence. So I read that as, we will help the Swedish population get psychologically ready for nuclear war or a range of other threats. Of course, modern civil defence, or total defence as we have it here, encompasses a range of threats, but we are interested in the big one, in nuclear war. So that is how I'm approaching this. I'm sorry, Sweden, I don't really care how you prepare for fires and floods. I want the good stuff. So if Sweden was facing a war situation, the main concern of the Psychological Defence Agency seems to be steeling the population against malign foreign influence and disinformation. Now, in a nuclear war scenario, this might mean that a foreign country, let's pick one at random, let's pick Russia. In a period of nuclear tension, Russia might be bombarding the Swedish population with fake news about nuclear war. There might be reports suggesting that Sweden's defence is worthless, and that if a nuclear attack came, they would be wiped out instantly. There might be reports suggesting that NATO wouldn't come to their aid. Maybe they would try to infiltrate Sweden's peace campaigns. Maybe they would fund or otherwise support a newspaper or online news channel and have it pump out anti-Western propaganda. Well, the Swedish Psychological Defence Agency wants to help the population recognise such fake news and resist malign foreign influence. Quote, our resilience will prevent or diminish the effects of antagonistic attempts to influence our decisions, perceptions, or behaviour. Now, speaking of the Swedish population's perception of, in this case, nuclear war, let's skip back in time to the 50s, to Stockholm in 1959, to be precise. 1959 was a relatively relaxed year in the Cold War. I say relatively because the rest of that decade was chock full of nuclear tensions and the revelations of new horrors. We had in the 50s the Korean War, of course. We had Klaus Fuchs being revealed as a spy, with all the misery and complications that would unlock for Britain and its hopes of nuclear cooperation with America. Not to mention the fact that his spying helped the Soviets get the bomb. And of course, once the Soviets had the bomb, that spurred America on. We need to go further, we need to go higher, we need to get the hydrogen bomb. And then of course the Soviets follow and everything just escalates. So Truman, in the 50s, gave the go-ahead to develop the super, as they called it, the hydrogen bomb. Even though it was against the advice of most of his top atomic scientists, including the big guy, Oppenheimer. Going on to 1952, Britain joins the nuclear club. And then a few months later, America tests its first hydrogen bomb. We have Eisenhower coming to power, Stalin dies. In New York, the Rosenbergs go to their deaths in the electric chair. Then the Soviets get the hydrogen bomb. The scary concept of massive retaliation is developed in America. You can find an episode on that in the archive, under the title Bash the Octopus on the Head. If you listen to it, you'll find out why it has that title. Onwards through the 50s, 1956 now, we have Soviet tanks entering Budapest to crush the uprising. 1957, Sputnik is launched. Khrushchev takes power, and at the end of 58, he issues an ultimatum to the Western powers saying he wants them out of West Berlin within 6 months. So, with all of that turmoil in the 1950s, it's almost a relief to leave NATO and the Warsaw Pact and slip over to Stockholm. Now, we were talking about the Swedish population's perception of a nuclear attack. You can't assume, of course, that a nuclear attack would be as simple as a bloke in Moscow presses a button and Stockholm vanishes in a hot white light. No, there are lots of different routes to nuclear attack, of course, and there are many ways to die in that attack. So the authorities decided, in September 1959, to put on a demonstration in Stockholm of an atomic attack. I must thank my listener, Jason Carter, here. He told me about this event, I had no idea about it, and he kindly translated a Swedish news article about it for me. So this demonstration in Stockholm was called Operation Stroman, and it saw huge crowds gather on the waterfront to observe the military display lots of their equipment, boats, planes and helicopters. To make it all seem more realistic and exciting, there were also soldiers running around in the streets, firing blanks at one another. Some soldiers were dressed in a grey-brown uniform to represent the enemy, an anonymous enemy, of course. So with all of this going on, all this action, all this display, all these theatrics in the street and on the water, it reminds me of the civil defence exercises held in Britain, also in the 1950s, where drama and costume and scripts were often used. And the whole thing carried out in full view of the often bemused public. I detail one of these in my book, Attack Warning Red. It happened in Coventry in 1954, where volunteers were asked to pretend to be wounded by an atomic blast and asked to lie in the street in fake rubble, moaning and wailing, and wait for the civil defence crews to bandage them up and haul them to safety. Things got a bit heated when arguments broke out because the local council in Coventry, who were supposed to be organising civil defence and running this exercise, had refused. They had point blank said to the Home Office, "We will not do this because we are a left-wing Labour council and therefore we are opposed to the whole notion that you can prepare for nuclear war." It was a particularly heated debate in Coventry because, of course, just a few short years before, Coventry had been absolutely battered in the Blitz. So the council felt particularly strongly that you can't prepare for nuclear war, you can't defend yourself against a nuclear attack. We will play no part in this. The Home Office said, "You're obliged to. If you don't do it, we'll send blokes in to do it instead. We'll do it for you." And that is indeed what happened. So when the Home Office teams turned up and began carrying out their big theatrical exercise on the streets of Coventry, protesters led by the council turned up with a loudspeaker and began to shout their protests, and there was what you would call a hullabaloo. So shouting broke out in the streets, and one old lady, who was playing one of the supposed victims of the atomic attack, was carrying a birdcage, and she, annoyed at the left-wing protesters, hurled the birdcage at them. So news of this public fighting and the flying birdcage reached Churchill, who grumbled, "I hope there isn't going to be any more of this sort of thing." because as I mentioned at the start of the podcast, nuclear civil defence was always dogged by the perception that it's just what we did in the Blitz, reheated for a nuclear attack, and therefore useless. So it already had an image problem. So fighting and scrapping in the streets and bird cages being thrown about certainly didn't help. But back to Stockholm. They too had their theatrics. They had the soldiers, the uniform, the fake shooting, the fighter jets swooping overhead, all the action on the river. It was all designed to prepare the public, to alert them, to say, yes, this is what war would look like. This is how an atomic attack might unfold. But it was also designed to, well, to be blunt, to entertain. It is a spectacle. There's no point having a public display, an exercise designed to educate and prepare the public, if they don't care. You've got to catch the eye. You've got to make them stop in their tracks and watch and be interested, intrigued, and yes, slightly uneasy. You want people to go home and think, it's about time I started learning about civil defence. Where's that leaflet they sent out that I lost in the kitchen drawer months ago? So you've got to shake off any kind of complacency, particularly in Sweden, which of course was a neutral country throughout the Second World War and throughout the Cold War. So the authorities didn't want any complacency to set in, with Swedish people perhaps thinking, well, if it does kick off, well, it's between NATO and the Warsaw Pact, isn't it? We are not involved. We must get rid of that complacency. And how better to do that than to produce a scenario which sees soldiers running under your window and shooting at the corner where you stop to buy your coffee and paper in the morning. So the crowds gathered to watch this fake war and this demonstration of a fake atomic attack. And yes, Operation Stroman managed to include a fake nuclear blast for the crowd. As the soldiers shot and ran and ducked in the streets, and as the boats gathered on the river, one eyewitness recalled, quote, "A highlight was when a mushroom cloud rose up behind the houses, and the loudspeaker voice explained that it would look like this when the enemy had detonated an atomic bomb." Another witness that day recalled, "I think it was a military display with fighter jets that swooped in at low altitude above the roofs. And then it was shot and it was supposed to represent an atomic bomb which detonated on the river. My little brother got scared and he hid behind a house wall up on Soder. I also watched adults doing the same thing. It was full on war on the river." Another eyewitness called Annette said, "I remember that I had trained at Hellisgarden and cycled home via Stadsgarden. I was surprised by a large crowd packed along the quay. A despairing boy of around 7 years old, who had not managed to force through the wall of people, cried bitterly, 'I want to see the atomic bomb!'" There are pictures which accompany the article. One of them shows the fake mushroom cloud rising up over Stockholm. The caption reads, "A mock-up atomic device was detonated over the water. A powerful flash of light and a large cloud of smoke was produced. On HMS Smaland, close to the site of the detonation, a fire broke out," a fire in quote marks, "which allowed for a demonstration of firefighting and atomic protection techniques." So Sweden went all the way with this demonstration. Soldiers and shooting and warships and planes and fake atomic explosions. Thinking back to the civil defence exercise I mentioned in Coventry, which also took place in the 50s, there's a very obvious difference. The British one seemed tame by comparison. But that is surely because Coventry had lived through the real thing, minus the atomic explosion, of course, just a few years previously. So it might have seemed crass, even cruel, to have explosions in the streets and planes roaring overhead, when the city would still have been full at this time of Blitz survivors. You also might argue that the people of Coventry needed no demonstration of what war would look like. They remembered it all too well, I'm sure. Whereas Sweden, being neutral in the Second World War and the Cold War, perhaps, I can't speak for Swedish people obviously, but perhaps it was thought that the population might need a bit of an elbow in the ribs to say, this is what it would look like, this could happen to us. Don't get too comfortable. But of course the risk when you put on a big display like this, which gathers crowds and has little kids crying because they can't get to the front of the crowd to witness it all, well, is there the risk that people might view it as entertainment? Did the crowds leave that day feeling that was a bloody good show? Did they lift their kids up on their shoulders to see the atomic mushroom cloud? Or did they all slink off home feeling uneasy and unsettled? Maybe you want a nice balance between the two. But the crucial thing is that a over-the-top demonstration of a obviously fake atomic attack on Stockholm caught the attention. Crowds were gathered by the riverside to watch. The individual was stopped in his tracks. People saw a mushroom cloud by their favourite coffee shop. They saw soldiers in the streets under their bedroom window. It was brought directly to the individual, instead of there being a vaguer notion that if war comes, it will be dealt with by the men and women in uniform, and the individual will stay passive. He will be at home, he will keep his head down, he will await instructions. Well, no, Sweden's concept of total defence is opposed to that kind of passivity. It wants the individual to be slightly unsettled and therefore jolted out of that passivity. Reminded that, well, why couldn't there be a mushroom cloud rising over your favourite coffee shop? What makes you so special? That is a thought which I often have, even now. Even with everything I've read, everything I'm immersed in constantly, even now, the thought creeps in that it won't happen here. It can't happen to me. When I was at school and we started learning about the Holocaust, which we learned about through English classes, history at school was dull and useless. I would read about it with the weird feeling that if I had been sent to a camp, I'd have survived. I couldn't accept that that could happen to me. But why not? And later, again in English, doing a talk on what I had learned through studying various novels about the Holocaust, Miss McCluskey, my teacher, asked me at the end of the talk, and do you think it could ever happen again? And I think in my head, I almost laughed. I wouldn't dare have laughed aloud at Miss McCluskey. But in my head, I remember thinking, daft question. And I said to her, well, no, of course not. And she said, why? And I had no answer. I was up there in front of the class, just standing there, kind of twisting my fingers in my school jumper, thinking, I've got no answer. So she was prodding me out of this privilege, I suppose, and complacency, because I've only ever lived in a safe country. Why couldn't it happen again? And why wouldn't it happen to you? And yes, even now, even if it's just a subconscious thought, I often have the feeling that it won't actually come here. Ukraine, okay, that's as far as it will get. And that was close enough. I mean, I've been to Ukraine. That really was quite shocking. That a country I have been to is now at war, under attack. But it won't come any closer to me than Ukraine, surely. But as Miss McCluskey asked when I was a stupid 14-year-old, but why not? As far as British civilians are concerned, did all wars stop forever in 1945? What are the chances that there would be some magical date in history, say V-Day, at which war halted? And what are the odds that I would be alive during this magical time? What makes me so special? Nothing. And that is the uncomfortable answer. That reminds me of Gone with the Wind. Now, that is my favourite novel. I know it's probably not politically correct to love it, but I do. It's a brilliant novel. And don't just dismiss it as a love story, it's also about how war changes a society. That's what the title refers to, of course. Everything that these privileged southern plantation owners thought was safe and secure, all gone with the wind of war, which obviously sweeps through the south. But the whole notion of, this could never happen to me, that's present in the novel after Scarlet flees Atlanta. So she's always been rich and privileged and spoiled and, of course, taken care of by slaves and by the wealth brought in by slavery. She has never experienced a single moment of hardship. And now, all of a sudden, she finds herself alone in the middle of a war zone with just her sick sister-in-law, two kids and a slave girl with her. They are all filthy and terrified and starving and gasping for water. There is no one to protect her. There is nowhere to go. There is nothing to do. She even smells bad. And to Scarlet in the novel, that is appalling, because she has always been a fragrant, pampered southern belle. And now, she stinks. She starves. And she is aghast. Even through all her fear, there still filters some spoiled brat outrage. Like, unthinkable that this can be real. How can this be happening to me, to Scarlet O'Hara? But we stray from the point, or I stray from the point. Let's get back to Sweden. Yes, their approach to civil defence is to bundle everything together, from the men in the military to the little old ladies at home. We all have a part to play in total defence. And in order to reach people in the home, where people might feel secure or disconnected from talk of war, we need to shake people out of the Scarlet O'Hara certainty that this cannot happen to me. And so perhaps that is why Stockholm arranged for a fake mushroom cloud to rise over the rooftops in 1959. To show everyone on the riverfront that this can happen to you. And here is a wee taste of what it might look like. Sweden also did what Britain never dared to do, which is post civil defence leaflets out to every household in the country. We know that in Britain we had Protect and Survive prepared and ready, but the point was never reached where millions of copies were produced and they were sent out en masse to every single household. That sparked a lot of conspiracy theories, of course, mutterings about why aren't they giving out this booklet? What are they trying to hide from us? And Leon Britton, who was in charge of it at the time, just said quite plainly, we're not hiding anything. It's just this thing is designed to go out when a certain point is reached, when nuclear war is deemed to be imminent. And thankfully, that hasn't been reached. Not yet. So therefore, it hasn't been sent out. There is no dark conspiracy. But in Sweden, they did issue leaflets. They sent out to households, and also during the Cold War, if you had lost your leaflet, they would print it in the back of the Swedish phone books. So it was always there, it was always accessible. And they did this again in, according to The Guardian, 2018. They updated their Cold War civil defence booklet, printed it out and sent it to the country's 4.8 million households. In Britain, of course, it was a far messier affair. The government wouldn't send out Protect and Survive for the reasons we've just discussed, but lots of local councils took it upon themselves to write, produce and distribute their own civil defence leaflets. And arguably, that did nothing but create confusion because the general message behind these booklets varied depending on the political makeup of your council. If you lived under a left-wing Labour council who supported the nuclear-free movement, then you would probably get a leaflet saying nuclear war will be horrific and there is no effective protection against it. We should all disarm. But if you lived under a Conservative supporting council, they would be more likely to toe the central government line and say, It would be dreadful if it happened, but it's unlikely. But if it does, here are practical steps and tips and advice you can follow. So, a bit of a mess, but Sweden, and I applaud them for it, were bold enough to produce a consistent message and send it out to every household. Now, during the Cold War, the leaflet was called If War Comes, but they updated it, as I said, in 2018 and called it If Crisis or War Comes. So again, Cold War is over, of course. There's more that we should be worried about than just nuclear war. We've got terrorism now, of course, cyber attacks, industrial accidents, fires, floods, pandemics. A million horrible things can happen to us. So the title reflects that with If Crisis or War Comes. So we've talked about how Sweden want to reach everyone. That's the idea of total defence. Everyone has a part to play. You can't leave it to others. You must get involved. So in order to help achieve this, in order to reach everyone, make everyone feel included, the Swedish government website currently has that leaflet so accessible that you can download a copy in English, Arabic, Farsi, Finnish, French, Yiddish, Russian, Spanish, Somali, Romanian, the Sami languages, and Tigrinese. I had to Google Tigrinese. It's a language spoken in Ethiopia and Eritrea. You can also get an audio version of the booklet. So Sweden have obviously gone to great lengths to make sure that everyone, almost everyone, is included. That they can read or listen to this. So whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, you might say, this is a great project on behalf of inclusivity. Everyone living here, you're all included. You're all regarded as part of a big Swedish family helping strengthen the country. Either that or making it so accessible is a way of chiding people. Hey, just because you don't speak Swedish doesn't mean you can wriggle out of this. Get reading, get prepared. No one gets to turn away from this duty. So let's look just quickly at the updated version, the 2018 version of the Civil Defence Leaflet, If Crisis or War Comes. It starts by making it clear that it's been issued in response to several threats, not just war. It says, the purpose of this brochure is to help us become better prepared for everything from serious accidents, extreme weather and IT attacks, to military conflicts. It goes on to say, everyone who lives in Sweden shares a collective responsibility for our country's security and safety. When we are under threat, our willingness to help each other is one of our most important assets. If you are prepared, you are contributing to improving the ability of the country as a whole to cope with a major strain. The message on the first few pages is that the authorities will work to get services back to normal, but until that happens, the individual, if he has done his homework and is properly prepared, will be able to get by on his own for a couple of weeks without needing government assistance, without needing help from the authorities. So therefore, that household will not be a burden on the state. And that frees up the state to help those who are truly vulnerable. Quote, help will be provided first to those who need it most. The majority must be prepared to cope on their own for some time. To get prepared, people must focus on four key things: making sure they have water, food, warmth, and that they can access information from government and media. But beware of false information. Be able to recognise fake news or malicious rumours planted or spread by an enemy power or a traitorous element within the country. It also advises you not to believe rumours and not to spread these rumours. Now, we kicked off this episode talking about the Second World War. Well, The concept of not gossiping or spreading rumours or leaking valuable information was another public information campaign in Britain during the war, and that coined well-known phrases like careless talk costs lives and keep mum, she's not so dumb. And of course the Americans had their own version in loose lips sink ships. But we, of course, are interested in nuclear war and in the Cold War. So let's skip back to their earlier booklets, which was published in 1961. Now, there was one during the Second World War that was issued in Sweden in 1943. Sweden was, of course, neutral in the Second World War, but very sensibly sought to remind the population that a threat still exists. So the booklet was first issued in 43. It was issued again in 1961, updated to meet the nuclear threat. And as I said earlier, you could also find that in the back of Swedish phone books. It was withdrawn, of course, at the end of the Cold War, but, as we mentioned, has now reappeared in another updated form. I am very glad to say I received a copy of the 1961 Swedish booklet yesterday morning, and I am hoping that I will be able to get it translated for you. In the meantime, I have added it as a PDF to my Patreon page, and I've made it accessible to everyone, not just to paying members. So jump over to patreon.com/atomichobo and you can see the full thing. It's about 30 pages long. So we will examine it in greater detail in next week's episode, by which time I will hopefully have had it translated for you. But for now, let's have a very quick glance. I used Google Translate to work out the text of one or two of the more sparse, easier pages. For example, the guidance on evacuation. Of course, if we're comparing it to Protect and Survive, we know that there was no evacuation in Britain, and we've discussed the reasons for that plenty of times in previous episodes. Sweden, however, did intend to evacuate its citizens, and the advice is that families should stay together, they should just bring essentials with them, they should take warm clothing. Of course, the climate in Sweden is far colder than it would be in Britain. So make sure you've got warm and dry clothing. Make sure that whatever you're carrying is light enough that you can carry it yourself. You should bring some cash with you. And again, that would be useless in Britain. We've talked again in the podcast before about how money would have no value after a nuclear attack. But we can assume that Sweden wasn't expecting to be annihilated as Britain probably would have been in a nuclear war. So we can imagine that there will still be shops and commerce in Sweden. So yes, in theory, you could be evacuated to a village or a small town out of the path of fallout, and there will be a shop there, and you can buy whatever you need. Whereas in Britain, a handful of cash and coins, you'll just be stumbling around through the dust with it, with nothing to do. So they're telling you to take money. They also say to take your health insurance documents, and Google Translate tells me it's your trade union book. You're also told to take, if it's been distributed, your ration cards, your gas mask, and ID cards. They also tell you what to pack when you're being evacuated, so that's warm clothing and food, etc. In Britain, of course, we were told to stockpile food, get clean clothes, warm blankets, etc. But the difference is we wouldn't have been packing them for an evacuation. We'd have been putting them in the fallout room, of course. But the Swedish are told to pack clothes, handkerchiefs, first aid box, sturdy shoes, a sheath knife, and enough food for 2 days. Now, the instruction to bring Swedish tinned food into a shelter or rest centre reminds me of the various YouTube videos of people being dared to eat surströmming. Now, if you don't know, that is fermented sour herring. And apparently the smell of it comes in little tins, and apparently the smell is so vicious and so offensive that, according to YouTube, some people retch and vomit when they smell it. I assume Swedish people don't, but lots of softy foreigners do. It is actually forbidden to bring a tin of it onto certain airlines, including BA, Air France, KLM, because of fears that the pressurised tins could explode in midair and everyone would be trapped on board with this vile smell. So I wonder if Swedish shelters had a no surstromming rule, or are the Swedes tough enough? But please do look up the surstromming challenge on YouTube and imagine someone cracking that tin open in a claustrophobic, stuffy fallout shelter. My favourite video is called Surstromming Five Guys, One Tin, and it's a bunch of big burly blokes in the back garden, and they've got a tin of the stuff, and they're all wearing wee plastic raincoats as they're terrified of getting any of the juice splashed on them. And they open the tin and they all end up vomiting and retching and howling and stumbling around as though they've been hit with some chemical weapon. So that's a question for our Swedish listeners. Would you take surstromming into your shelter? So next week, we will examine in more detail the Swedish 1961 booklet, and we will go on to look also at their siren and shelter network. I have a listener in Sweden called Jason, and Jason has kindly offered to translate the booklet for me. So incredibly grateful to Jason. I offered to send him a signed copy of my book as a thanks, but good old Jason, he's already got a copy. So thank you, Jason. So thanks to him, we have a translation, or I will shortly have a translation of the full thing. I was prepared to use Google Translate if I couldn't get a Swedish person or a Swedish speaker to translate it for me. But Google Translate, of course, doesn't offer any context. And let me give you an example. This happened this morning, of how the context is so important. I uploaded, as I said, a PDF of the booklet this morning to my Patreon page. And I mentioned in my commentary alongside it that one of the pages had a picture of a tiger on it. And I wasn't sure why. Now, if I had used Google Translate, it would have easily translated tiger for me, of course. But I needed a Swedish person to tell me the context behind the picture of the so-called En Svensk Tiger. And thankfully, one of my patrons is, I assume, Swedish, and he explained why the tiger was there. What on earth was a tiger doing in a nuclear civil defence booklet? Well, if you look at my Patreon, which, as I say, I've made this post available to all, he explains that in Swedish, the word tiger has a double meaning. It refers to the animal, obviously, but can also be used to mean silence. I suppose that's because tigers are silent and stealthy when they hunt. So, during the Cold War, a blue and yellow tiger, En Svensk Tiger, was used as a symbol for being careful and quiet in wartime, not to spread rumours and gossip or leak important information. That is what the tiger symbolises. And that neatly takes us back to the Blitz, where we kicked off this episode, talking about how London can take it. And then the other wartime slogan, keep mum, she's not so dumb. Careless talk costs lives. So that is what the tiger in the nuclear civil defence booklet signifies. And Google Translate, of course, would not have told me that. So pop over to Patreon, patreon.com/atomichobo. And of course, if you are Swedish and you have anything to add, then certainly leave a comment there and we can have a chat about it. So thank you for listening, and I'll be back next week with a fuller investigation of the Cold War booklet, If War Comes.